Hello, this is Charles Stewart, and this is the regular Saturday afternoon conference of a community of people that are coming together under the name of the Supreme Court of Law for the United States of America. This is a bold proposition, but we think the times deserve some bold propositions on the table here. We're in the habit of opening our conferences with prayer to the higher forces in the spirit realm. In the Abrahamic Christian tradition. So if y'all might indulge me here briefly, true God, Yahweh, Jehovah, we humbly seek your guidance and direction. Please send your angels and your Holy Spirit. Please help us to all remember the importance of being humble so that we can work together effectively to advance the cause of truth and justice, and that all of us might sincerely commit ourselves to refraining from being angry at our brothers and sisters, unless only we become seriously concerned that they might not be maintaining honorable standards of behavior, such as is necessary for our qualified electors, and such as is the tradition amongst Christian Protestant communities. And hereunder, again, we humbly ask your angels and your Holy Spirit to guide and direct the words that all of us choose to share herein. Please keep us humble. Please help us to advance your kingdom of truth and justice on this earth. And in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Yeshua, we humbly pray these things. Amen. Okay. Agenda item 2. A, preliminary concerns. Are there any new cases to be placed on the docket for our Supreme Court of Law of the United States of America, right under our agenda item 2A? You can see the four cases that we've got listed below, and we'll be revisiting details on at least one or two of them as we proceed here. Are there any new cases to be brought before our court here from anybody in attendance here? Anyone? Okay, hearing none. And proceeding. Agenda item 2B. Are there any new agenda items to be listed on our agenda for our next week's scheduled conference? Anybody?
If I may, Michael in Florida.
Michael.
Yeah, I think it would be appropriate that every conference call we have a brief time of anyone that has any announcements or news or current events that they feel need to be made known. Not petty or trivial current events, but anything significant or timely would be relevant, I think, and serve the group well. I would propose that.
Thank you. Point of information. I can't help but think that being that this proposal is early in the agenda and we do need to get to scheduled business, should we have a time limit on such brief news item proposals?
Yeah, I think 5 to 10 minutes max would be.
I'd think 5 minutes would be a better max when we've got, frequently we've got a lot on our agenda that's lined up, and we can always get into details more in later discussion if that's how the conversation leads. I would suggest.
Yeah. Well, we can. Yeah, we can try 5 minutes, see how that works out.
All right. Are there comments or questions on the proposition from Michael here, from anybody in attendance here? Hearing none. Yes, definitely, Michael. I'll put that as worded 5-minute summary I'll add that to the next agenda. I'll plan on it. My note-taking capabilities are not real efficient right now. Maybe redundancy is good to remind me, but I'll try to remember it, and I think chances are good I'll be able to do that. Moving on, we got one new agenda item submitted for us for next Saturday's conference. Item 2C on our agenda. Michael here has submitted a new item. Here under pointing out that we, as an organic body politic and responsibly self-governing juror society, assembly, and community, should all be formally delegating authority from our constituent community members to whoever we might collectively choose to represent our Supreme Court of Law to the outside world. I, Charles Stewart, have temporarily assumed this otherwise vacant office, whereunder I am serving as this court's pro tem chief judicial officer and moderator. But Michael has correctly pointed out that this temporary assumption of these official and necessary public duties is undermined in its appearance of legitimacy when the chief representative of our community is only filling that duty on a temporary basis. And I would like to ask Michael to explain how he thinks, and maybe even take the ball, because as a pro tem leader here, everything so far is just pro tem, and I feel kind of awkward pursuing the agenda myself, conflict of interest assumption. So, Michael, could you go ahead and take the ball and pursue this line of thought further here?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Charles. I think in this process that we're in the midst of, it's only appropriate that we do it organically and allow the people involved to manifest their consent. You know, it's our consent that we're governed by. And I'm thankful that Charles has stepped up to the plate of this responsibility and creating this this court for the people. And I just wanted to make it a process of consent of the governed by nominating Charles. And this is the process by which the founders did it too. They nominated each other for different positions that they felt were fitting and appropriate in the various committees they created and in the various functions that they did. So I would like to officially nominate Charles to be our judicial officer, expert, legal expert, lawful expert, and I would urge anyone else to second that, and I think he would serve us well in this capacity. And I think it's also fitting that we begin to consider others that we know that maybe don't even participate in this call that we feel should be, you know, nominated to be a delegate of this activity that we're engaging in, the pursuit of self-governing communities. We're going to need to find people to you know, take on different responsibilities that have different, you know, ideas and different capacities of knowledge. You know, not everybody is going to be good at this thing or that thing, but everybody has a particular niche of knowledge that they can be good at. And I think we need to find that in people and nominate them to be a part of this work. And that would reflect the process of the consent of the governed. So that's what it's all about. We're not, you know, a cult. We're not a guru group. We're not a dictatorship by any one big man person that is leading us like a lot of these other groups are. I didn't like the NLA years ago because it seemed like it was a dictatorial organization, and there were things taking place that did not allow due process. And I think that's a very important aspect of what we're doing, is to have due process and consent. So at that, I will yield and would offer it up to a second to nominate Charles as our judicial officer. I yield. Thank you.
Lewis of Michigan, if I may.
Lewis.
I would second the nomination just put forward by Mike. I yield.
Thank you, Lewis. That point, I guess with our small community here, maybe we can just call for, is there the yeas and the nays, I guess? The nays first. Are there any nays among us?
Or any discussion?
Yeah, any further discussion would be even. Yeah, discussion is the Robert's Rules order and logically appropriate before the call for the yeas and nays. Is there any further discussion on the point on the table? Hearing none. Is there any nays? Hearing none. Call for the yeas.
Yay.
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 Okay. It appearing to the chair that the yays are over and above the nays. The proposition on the table is hereby approved. And thank you all for the vote of confidence here in my leadership capability. And that little formality right there, I was really glad Michael brought it forward. That significantly helps me as I'm composing documents and things. I can word from a more authoritative standing. I've got some colorable delegation of authority here to actually be proceeding in the best interest of the American people. It's not just me presuming it out of a vacuum. This is a significant feather in my cap and step forward for all of us, I do believe. So I want to thank Michael especially for bringing this forward, and I want to thank all of you for your vote of confidence here. And at that point, I don't see David Scheid with us. David made a point that he wanted to be in conference and talk about his case a little bit, and this would be the appropriate place to do it, or maybe after our business meeting, or maybe we'll have time a little bit before the close of that if David comes in. But Michael did also ask for opportunity to take, I think, hopefully you can do it within 5 minutes, Michael, building on your case before our court, actually, of the election fraud. Michael, would you like to give a news report update on concerns in this area?
Sure. Thank you, Stuart or Charles. The evidence continues to come in, and it's quite revealing, especially the one truck driver that testified that he drove a truck full of ballots from New York to Pennsylvania. And he's getting quite a bit of attention, including attention from the FBI that's not been too appropriate. And Lou Dobbs on Fox Business has taken him up as a cause and is giving him quite a bit of airtime to show his evidence and to keep the people abreast of his situation. And it's getting very interesting, to say the least. I think in the days ahead, we really need to stay tuned to further manifestations of evidence and hearings that are being conducted at different state levels. I think it's going to be very telling, and it's going to show us who the real the real freedom fighters are and who the counterfeits are. And that includes commanding officer, Mr. Trump. It's time for him to step up to the plate, and if he believes what he says, then this is an appropriate time to make some sort of act or action regarding criminal behavior that he alleges. And if he fails to do so, that will be a sad day for America. And I was tuned in today to several live streams from Washington, D.C., and there's quite a bit of activity there, and a lot of great speeches by average common citizens were given, and it was very interesting. Right Side Broadcasting was one that covered it. NTD is another one. I just think we're in very historic times, and the momentum is growing, the resistance is growing, and we couldn't ask for a better environment to be doing what we're doing. So I'm glad for that. And with that, I'll yield. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Is there comments or questions on Michael's news update and commentary here?
If I may.
Paul, I was hoping you might chime in. You've got a dog in this fight also, don't you there, Paul?
Yes, sir. We have a pretty big dog in this fight. I think I sent you a copy of the petition that was to be filed for the grand jury, federal grand jury in Atlanta to take administrative control of criminal investigations. Did I send that to you?
I believe you did, sir.
Okay. Well, it was submitted with the signatories numbering 44. One of whom was out of the state of New York. And it arrived, I received notification from the post office that it was placed in the federal mailbox, the U.S. courthouse mailbox, on December the 7th. Since that time, we have not heard from any member of the grand jury, the foreman, or anyone else. I am supposing that the grand jury is probably seeking some explanation that they can understand of the legal pleading that was presented. But for the purposes of the general population, it is sufficient to say that that pleading was a request for the United States grand jury to open its own investigation, independent of any other governmental agency, to supervise and control that investigation, even to the point of compelling FBI and U.S. Department of Justice officials to bring any evidence of misconduct in the federal election cycle and lay it before them for their consideration.
Mm-hmm.
I'll yield.
Thank you. Comments or questions from other members of the group here?
Yeah, Abraham, Nevada.
Abraham.
Yeah, I was wondering who else may have heard that Trump has positioned two very large naval strike forces on each end of the coast, the East Coast and the West Coast, consisting of aircraft carriers, destroyers, and a whole host of other military vessels. And the word is they're expecting to thwart some kind of an invasion because they're expecting this thing with the differences of voting and who's going to be in charge to go really very dramatic and extreme. I saw some credible posts on it, and I moved them around, and before some people got a chance to see them, they all disappeared. They sounded very credible. If anybody else is aware of more detailed information on this, it'd be good to share it, because that's pretty hair-raising. I yield.
Thank you, Abraham. Yeah, that's a slightly different subject. I think we were that's a worthy subject, no doubt. But I think we were kind of trying to get some conclusion to the other issue about the election fraud here. To continue on with election fraud, is there comments or questions on the election fraud that Paul Nally and Michael Zarzano was bringing to the table?
Lewis, just with a comment.
Yes.
I like what Paul has presented, and see that now that's sensical. When you're making a request for any and all evidence to be presented, bring it forward. Outside of allegations and presentations with charts and things that you and I could have put together to present whatever position we chose to, but actual evidence presented to a federal grand jury, those type of efforts I actually support. Many of these other things that have been going on, I believe that it, had anyone else brought these actions forward, they would have been considered frivolous, and some would have actually faced fines for doing so. I've seen that type of action and been involved with that type of action where a woman brought forth attempting to position herself as a common law wife of my brother-in-law after his very sudden passing, and I've seen there's no end to what people have the ability to do with the legal system, and you know, in terms of depositions and trying to move forward with cases and such. But actual evidence, I support that 100%. So Paul's effort. So I, with that, I yield.
Thank you, Lewis.
May I?
Cindy, yes?
Yeah, this is Cindy in Florida. What I would love to see happen across this nation, and the beauty, it would be a beautiful thing if it would start right here on this call, is for this country to see this as an attack on we the people, not an attack on the Democratic Party, not an attack on the Republican Party, because that is exactly what our founders warned us about in choosing party. But if we could just lay our political colors aside and all of us act as purple, then we could come to a resolution of this, because this is not about Trump. This is not about Biden. This is about we the people being robbed of our liberty and our freedom and our honest election. There have mm-hmm. been things presented, and our bias has got to be laid aside, that the truth can be made, can be revealed, because this is about we the people. I yield.
Thank you, Cynthia. Further comments, questions?
May I add a bit?
Yes, Paul, go ahead.
I would point out, too, that the language of our petition was nonpartisan. That is to say, we don't care what political party may have had any influence in formatting or fomenting malfeasant conduct. We are asking the grand jury to look at everybody equally, look at the evidence equally, and then make a determination. And I would state further that these 44 men and women, by taking this action in their petition, are exercising their duty as sitting board members of these two large corporations, the United States government and the state government. So they were willing to get off the couch, get out in front of that one-eyed monster, and take the time to bring their evidence and bring their petitions and their remonstrances before a federal grand jury. And right now we're just waiting on subpoenas from the grand jury. Thank you, and I will yield.
Thank you, Paul Nally, out of Georgia. I see Chris Cave joined with us. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you very much. Sorry I'm a little late. I had took the first number in my text to call, and that was the one for the Paul Guralli call, apparently. So I was waiting, and nobody came on the call. So I thought, I think I messed up.
I'm glad you made it here. We were discussing Michael and Paul have both presented a news item about current issues concerning the election and allegations of fraud and deception there.
You know, I'm intimately familiar with that. The fraud is right smack dab in your face, and they're being willfully blind, consciously not taking knowledge and cognizance of it. And that's a criminal act, because these are all deep state actors out of the DOJ and the FBI and other agencies who are willfully blind, who under one, that's USAM, the United States Attorney Manual 1.400, you'll find on page 20 of their ethics document that they are 30-year or more deep state bureaucrats, and therefore they are deep steeped into the federal government's policies, and they have no concept of law, not to mention William Barr is a former CIA operative asset attorney for the CIA. So he's certainly a deep state extraordinaire.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, Charles. Charles,
yes.
If I may. We need to identify one new caller. New caller, last four digits will be 2700. Can you identify yourself?
Yes, this is Matt in Michigan.
Greetings.
Matt from Michigan?
Welcome, Matt in Michigan.
Yeah, welcome, Matt. You've got a reputation among us, a good reputation. Glad to have you with us here.
Nice to be here.
All right. Continuing on, I think we've kind of gone over our 5-minute limit. This is supposed to be a brief section, but it is an important, significant one, and I think it is worthy of taking just a little bit more time here to discuss. I believe the technicalities of the issue from the Supreme Court dismissing the case from the Attorney Generals of Texas was that the Supreme Court, federal de facto municipal, said that technically speaking, the states are in control of their own elections, and the Supreme Courts of the states should be adjudicating whether or not there is unlawful process there, not the Supreme Court of the federal government. And although that is causing a little bit of a problem to some of us, I do think that overall that is a good thing, because I think the biggest danger to all of our people is through excessively centralized federal authority, including that of the judiciary. And I think our grassroots community empowerment effort is actually supported and empowered even further if we're not fighting the big, ugly federal Supreme Court, but we're fighting various state-level Supreme Courts. I think that works to our advantage, and I think instead of a national Supreme Court of law like what we're doing here, trying to adjudicate the issue, we should be maybe doing a general resolution, but technically we should be looking for all of our grassroots activists to assume the vacant positions of judicial officers, at least temporarily, to assemble juries and actually act as Supreme Courts of law in their various states, and thereunder each of the states should adjudicate their state election results. And that would be harmonious with the current federal court decision. It would actually be empowered. Our actions there would actually be empowered. We might have the Texas Attorney General agreeing with some of these state-level Supreme Courts of law pursuing an agenda like that. So anyway, that would be my idea of how our forum here might harmonize with the unfolding dynamic before us in manners which place us in a strategic position on the cosmic chessboard as this spiritual battle is unfolding. Are there further comments and questions on this issue? I yield.
Just Chris has a bit of an observation. It appears to me, from my point of view of the world, that notwithstanding that it's a corporate rump, imposter Supreme Court that's been occupied and has several members that are seriously compromised and co-opted, nevertheless, it should be that these states could go to there because it's a controversy between different states and the people therein and their ability to access fair, neutral, unbiased elections as opposed to a fixed or stolen or ballot stuffed or foreign manipulated election like we've had here for the past few cycles. And this pretty much flies in the face of fair elections. Of course, most Americans don't cognize that whenever they sign up to vote for president and vice president, they're committing treason against the states they live in, and they have no authority to do that. Qualified electors are supposed to be the ones that select the president and the vice president from the states and the representatives, at least the Senate. And, of course, they had some convoluted jurisdiction or legislation they passed to do that under the 17th Amendment. However, the wheels are coming off the wagon. It's becoming blatantly clear to most of the American people that this Supreme Court is compromised. It's shirking its duty. It's rolling over, playing dead instead of going in and taking a case on the merits like they have, where certain states are disenfranchised by the criminality of other states, and that's precisely what the design of the Supreme Court was supposed to be. But I think you're exactly right on the right path there. The people's Supreme Court should be the ones, because when the government lacks the political will to prosecute cases against people that it's in cahoots, in bed with, compromise with, or in league with as a racketeering influence corporation's operation like it is right now. This is nothing but a RICO scam, and this is a criminal government and a criminal DOJ and FBI, and they have no sensitivity to the will of we the people. And, of course, whenever you proxy vote, you're basically giving your vote to the representatives to use however they want to, and that seems to be a very difficult circumstance for most people to grapple with. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further comments or questions?
If I may.
Paul, I presume, from The Voice, right, Paul?
Yes, sir.
Please, yes, Paul, go ahead.
When I first heard the news of the Supreme Court decision, I, needless to say, was sadly disappointed. But this morning, I had an opportunity to read the initial statement of the Supreme Court, and it's extremely short. It's just two paragraphs. And what immediately dawned on me was the Supreme Court was not denying that there were injuries done, but at the same time, neither were they admitting that injuries were done. What they were doing was focusing on what I think is a shortcoming in the pleading, the nature of the pleading of the state of Texas in its motion to bring the case before the Supreme Court. And what they said was that the state of Texas did not demonstrate standing to bring the matter to the court. Now, in order to understand what's going on, you need to realize that over the centuries, our court system has devised a very stringent form of practice and procedure. And before you can jump to whatever step two is, you've got to meet step one. Well, it just so happens that there are three elements in case law history and in statutory law. There are three elements that have to be addressed in the first motion. In order to have standing, you must first demonstrate an injury in fact or an immediate injury that's about to happen. You must demonstrate causation and redressability. And having read the motion from Texas, if I recall what I read correctly, they did address causation and they did address redressability, but they forgot to address the injury in fact. And because of that, I believe, now I could be wrong, but I believe that their failure to address the injury in fact, one, of all of the individuals, citizens in Texas, and two, the injury to the state of Texas as a corporate, as a entity that is both corporate and politic, they missed one of the elements and did not fulfill their obligation to cause the Supreme Court to exercise its jurisdiction to hold a full hearing on the matter. Now, I hope that helps explain why the Supreme Court took the step that it did. And I yield.
Thank you, Paul. Further comments or questions? This is no doubt an enchanting issue, a prioritized issue, but I do think maybe we should table it. Maybe we can revisit it later in the conference, and certainly after the formal conclusion of our business meeting. Is there? I would like to at least briefly cut out the concern that Abraham has expressed here. A little bit of time for that. Also, before we move on to agenda item 3, is there any objection to bringing to a close at this point in this discussion anyway our concerns about the election fraud allegation issues? Any objections? Hearing none. Abraham, I think Chris came in after you expressed your concerns about the aircraft carriers and Mr. Trump's actions related to them. Could you re-again summarize?
There was an article that was released about 3 days ago saying that there were two very large naval fleets, one positioned in the East Coast and along the entire East Coast, and another one positioned along the West Coast, but consisting of multiple aircraft carriers, destroyer groups, lots of hardware, and the buildup of military forces in the bases nearby, and saying it's directly due to this voter thing going on, because I guess, from what the article was saying, they're having a lot of doubts about the stability of the country, and they're expecting either an invasion or to repel an invasion. Something like that, and I distributed the article that I put around to a lot of people, and they all disappeared.
Abraham, thank you for that summary. You've got a lot of background noise there. Is there comments or questions about Abraham's concern about aircraft carriers being mobilized here?
If just Chris might bring a little additional to the table that could very well be related to Abraham's observations. It was reported by a very studied retired military fellow that I know here in Las Vegas that there were about 40, I think they were C-17, some sort of a large transport. I wasn't clear on which nomenclature it was. I did, just a couple of moments ago, drive by that location of Nellis Air Force Base to see if I could see a conflagration of those. However, I do know there is a separated housing facility of substantial size at Nellis where they could have, the people or equipment could have been dropped and secreted at a different location, and the equipment they needed put away in perhaps a warehouse for later retrieval. Sorry for the noise. But these types of maneuvers are certainly concerning, at the very least. Whether they're good or bad, we don't know. But being aware of what's going on, I think, is a part of doing due diligence and having critical analytical abilities to connect dots and supply intel of what's going on, so at least we have some sense. And there seem to be a large grouping of manning up operations within the United States, which is domestic as opposed to foreign. Of course, it might be to oppose foreign agents, or it could be to assist foreign agents. It's just too early to tell, in my estimation. But thank you for taking my information.
Thank you, Chris. Is there further comments or questions on this issue?
If I may, Michael in Florida, I think we need to keep perspective in mind here that there's a lot of information floating around. I've been hearing about this for about 2 weeks now. And there's really no way to prove it other than, photographic or video evidence. We're even having people claim that, the CIA was raided in Germany and they confiscated some of these voting servers in Germany. And this has not been proven, but it's been rumored for 2 weeks now on the internet, and there's just no substantiated evidence to prove it. And I think we need to be very careful. I'm not saying what Abraham is reporting not true, but we really need to find the evidence and let the evidence speak for itself. Otherwise, we're purely speculating. I yield. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Is there comments or questions on this issue of looming military dangers from anybody else? Hearing none.
If I may, I would like to kind of support what Michael said about when he said it kind of triggered with me. I think that has to be one of the greatest jobs amongst all of these assemblies, conferences and stuff, is that it should be our job to weed through the rumors and only report on what we know to be actual facts. I yield.
Thank you. Thank you. Or at least I think things like when we don't have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I think it is good to at least look at solid evidence, even though it might not be beyond a reasonable doubt, and we certainly don't want to get entangled in sensationalism and go chasing rabbits, because our time and energies here are precious. We are trying to accomplish valuable work for actually saving our nation in a real, tangible manner. So that is true, no doubt. But there's a balancing act that's kind of delicate there of whether or not we're just indulging endless series of speculation, or if we're just at least being alerted that there may be a concern here that we should at least be watching for more developments on. So it's kind of a balancing act, and I think each of us have to make our own decisions there. But yes, in that spirit, I want to thank Abraham for bringing that to the table and for rejoining our conference after a bit of a hiatus there. Thank you, Abraham. And continuing on, I think that about covers agenda item 2. Especially David Scheid has not shown yet. David, David Scheid, are you here? I don't see you in the list of attendees there. And I don't hear you responding, so we're going to go ahead and move on. I think next we're moving on to agenda item 3, precisely as Lewis is displaying it in the screen sharing there for those of you that have got your screen sharing turned on. And this has implications for the election fraud issue and even the issue about the aircraft. This issue is about the nature of the judicial power under our American system of constitutional government. Yes, excellent. Thank you, Lewis, for bringing up the related documents. And words are just appearing in my mind now. I love these conferences. I get inspirations when I'm under pressure like this. The bigger picture is that, and I've said it before, but it just kind of sounds like warm and fuzzy ambiguities, but the cold hard fact is that the closer you get to the grassroots, the greater the physical world empowerment really is. This is why our town constables at the 10 household community levels, they are the ultimate people with the ultimate guns in their local township communities, and they've got the authority to point those guns at anybody that they decide to and bring them into their local court of law or any other court of law that's appropriate. So long as they're acting in good faith, they have the right to do that. And my focus here is just on demonstrating that if you can think in your mind of a sphere, like an egg, the intellectual metaphysical mumbo-jumbo is all dealt with in the center. It's soft, it's pliable, lots of communication going on. But the people that administer the force, that, like the eggshell, it's on the outside. That's where the hard, tangible resistance to the outside world, the lawless people, really happens. It's through our town constables, and they're under through their deputy constable peace officers, which are each of the qualified electors, basically. And here under, right above the town constables, is the 100 courts at the precinct level. And that's what I'd like to focus on here, because this is where the phrase original and exclusive jurisdiction comes from. And lots of courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, claim original jurisdiction, and I think to some extent they also claim exclusive. But these are common law terms, and the Constitution document of the federal government, as well as all of the state court Constitution documents, they are municipal charters in their essential nature. They created a private corporation for a public purpose that's a municipal private corporation here to serve a public purpose. It's not an assembly of the constituents like the Supreme Court of the precinct, the 100 court. They have real common law jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction to form their jury and to try the case there, if that's where the breach of the peace is alleged to have occurred, okay? And the county court and the state-level Supreme Court and the federal Supreme Court and all of the other courts at the higher levels above the precinct, they are only there to be drawn into play if there is demonstrated clearly some problem with the manner in which the precinct court that was in charge of the original case adjudicated the matter. And so remember, like the egg, everything's on the outside, right above the ability to administer force with guns through the town constables at the township level. The next step up, the judicial original and exclusive jurisdiction, where the 100-man army, like a Roman centurion described in the Bible, has the authority to go anywhere and tell anybody what to do, so long as it's related to a case before the court. That is where this rubber really meets the road. And this is affirmed basically in the Sixth and the Seventh Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I don't like the U.S. Constitution document, basically, but the Bill of Rights contains all kinds of pearls of wisdom and empowerment that empower us in the Sixth and Seventh Amendment, work with the Seventh Amendment and the First Amendment and all the other amendments really, really well. And so we can win this battle. The law's on our side. We've got the moral high ground. We've got the legal high ground, lawful high ground. And here under, I would like to go ahead and jump into agenda item 3, where we're discussing the profound powers of the precinct-level judicial officers, as we're describing it in our organizing self-governing communities document, from the bottom of page 9 through the center of page 10. Yes, thank you for pulling that up precisely, Lewis. Here under, a few citations to some state statutes will clearly show how this all-important judicial power has been profoundly decentralized, right on down to the precinct levels of local government. And here we're citing some Oregon statutes. Oregon statutes clearly recognize this at ORS 1.270, wherein is clearly referenced that every other judicial officer, excluding the municipal jurisdiction ones, may be chosen from the precinct level of politically subdivided county jurisdiction. That Oregon statute clearly references the precinct choosing their judicial officers. And Michael, I think we've had specific conversation about tangible, real-world empowerment of these precincts and these local judicial officers. This is one citation from Oregon statutes that specifically references this kind of power being in the precincts. And to cover an issue that is again mentioned later in this section of the outline, even though we're citing Oregon statutes, every state except Louisiana has embraced common law as general public law that's to be applied in a de jure capacity as opposed to the de factos that Lewis is concerned about. De jure, organic public law of the people, is based on common law. And every state in the union has formally embraced this as general policy, except the state of Louisiana, which is under the authority of, has formally embraced Roman Empire municipal administrative law. But continuing on, the Oregon statutes here referenced merely articulate correctly, I believe, general common law principles, and thereunder, even if you can't find similar statutes in your state when you're trying to pursue this line of thought and grassroots empowerment for your community, you can cite the Oregon statute as a an authority of correct application of principles of common law in your state. And also, even if you don't have statutes as powerfully worded as the Oregon statutes, frequently case law related to those issues will provide you some type of color of legitimacy for advancing these kind of arguments in a plausible manner against entrenched de factos. But moving forward with these statutes past the issue that there is, this is at the precinct, at the grassroots decentralized level, like an egg with the stability, the force, the supreme peacekeeping authority for the judicial power at that grassroots precinct level. Moving on to exactly what kind of power that these courts of justice, they're referred to in Oregon statutes, that phraseology is harmonious with the court of law, like we are, because justice is the supreme law, and all real law promotes justice. It's just that simple. It's an organic process at these higher levels where we're bound by principles. And so Oregon statute particularly, 1.010 and subsection 4 elaborates clearly by recognizing that the courts of justice over which these precinct-level judicial officers preside have lawful authority to compel obedience to its judgments, orders, and process, and to the orders of of a judge out of court in a suit or proceeding pending therein. Thank you, Lewis. So the judge by himself has power. There's other Oregon statutes that refer to the difference between a judge and a court. That's real valuable surgical precision because, yeah. Well, anyway, I won't get distracted on that. But that's a real good embodiment of ORS, this powerful statute, ORS 1.010, subsection 4. Continuing on to summarize subsection 5, continues to clearly recognize that this power extends to control, in the furtherance of justice, the conduct of all other persons in any manner connected with a judicial proceeding before it, in every matter appertaining thereto. That wording is extremely empowering. If we might I'm a little bit lost for my notes here.
Boy, I sympathize with that.
The focus that we're moving towards is a subsection of this Oregon statute. Let me pull up my own document in PDF here real quick. Yes. Subsection 2. I do believe, yes. Subsection 2. Every court of, I do believe Lewis has probably got that up in the notes. I don't have my I'm a little bit disorganized. Subsection 2. Every court of justice in the larger context, every court of justice has power. This should be in the agenda items. I don't have that clearly in front of me. Every court of justice has power to enforce order in the proceedings before it, or before, this is the important part, or before a person or body empowered to conduct, quote, a judicial investigation, unquote, under its authority. This particular provision, and it's, again, to repeat myself, this is a general common law principle applicable to every state in the Union. I dare suggest even Louisiana could be brought under its pressure, that when a judicial officer, a legitimate judicial officer from one of the precincts has a lot on his table, but he has authority to delegate to activists that come to him, that seem responsible, to delegate to them authority to conduct these, quote, judicial investigations, okay, unquote. Now your precinct level leader no longer has to be directly vulnerable. He no longer has to risk getting arrested by cops or anything. Somebody that's outraged and is generally responsible can go down there with a few witnesses and confront the devil worshippers that are perverting our constitutional republic into a bag of pillage and plunder parasites. So, this authority to conduct judicial investigations is the main issue that I wanted to emphasize for decentralizing power, because remember we described the egg of how the supreme judicial power is at the precinct level of the approximately 300,000 precinct level jurisdictions all across the USA, and even further decentralization of power goes down, multiplied by 10, to the even smaller jurisdictions of the 10 household communities, if you calculate that based upon already mapped out precincts in the USA, that amounts to 3 million townships with a vacant office of a town constable for each of those. And they're under qualified electors. Multiply by another 10 would be authorized to conduct these just judicial investigations, at least if they got formal paperwork from the judicial officer indicating that. And I briefly discussed this with Abraham here a little bit. And Abraham came up with a scenario that he articulated about a Samoan that was doing debt collecting practices. But he would come into a room with a video camera. Abraham, are you still with us? Are you able to briefly share your description of how your Samoan friend with a few supporters and a video camera come in and basically really quickly and efficiently got compliance from everybody in the room? Abraham, are you able to articulate a little bit there?
Yeah, I have a security company in the Bronx, and we often put money out on the street where we would pay for the equipment and put it into commercial entities, you know, a repair garage or some other kind of a business entity, and we would, you know, loan them money and buy the equipment, and then they would make us payments. And when they fell behind in payments, sometimes they thought they could get away with it because all they saw was me and my partner, so they figured they could play games. So we hired this very large Samoan who was a bodyguard for some very famous rap groups. Very smart guy. This guy was gigantic. And we hired him, and he was going to assist us in collections. And in those days, this is probably about 15 years ago, maybe 20. And he had a pen camera. And in those days, people knew about them, but you didn't really see it very often. And when he walked into in this case it was a parts store, an automotive parts store, and he walked into the parts store holding this pen camera up, as though it really wasn't recording, but they didn't know that. And he starts quoting ordinance, and he starts quoting subsections of laws as he's walking into the thing, holding up this pen camera, and saying, oh, you know, all actions before me are being recorded to be used in a court of law. And then he starts quoting portions of the contract that we wrote, and he starts talking about if there's going to be an adverse action or if anybody's going to act unruly, it's being recorded by the pen camera, and it will be brought up in front of a judge. And by him carrying on this way, he entirely quelled any kind, because this is the Bronx, and the people can get very rowdy over there, and they would test you, and they would definitely test you. But the way this giant Samoan came out with that camera, he had everybody, it was very effective and extremely intimidating. And when I watched him do that, I thought, wow, this was absolutely brilliant. The way in which he used that pen camera to get total cooperation and get every, you could see the look on the faces of the people who were working in this place. You could tell they weren't going to try to pay us the money, but when they heard this guy go through with what he did, we certainly got paid, and we didn't have any kind of aggressive resistance or in some way counter intimidation, because the way in which he moved forward with that pen camera, confident and quoting sections of regulations, it was just very powerful, very persuasive, and you could see immediately the effect it had in everything in front of him. And I think that maybe there's something there to take note of.
Thank you, Abraham. I'd like to pause at this point. And is there comments or questions about what we're discussing so far from anybody? Okay. Nobody has any comments or questions? There is a little bit more in this subsection 3 I would like to go through. And I do have my copy of the agenda finally pulled up, so I'm not so dependent on Lewis's display there, which is generally excellent, but I need to control my own. And I'm sorry I didn't have that earlier. Anyway, on with business. These motivated activists, these when people come to us, they routinely ask us, well, how does your wonderful program, how is that of any benefit to me? Well, when we can tell them that our judicial officer can empower them to conduct a judicial investigation that can be engineered in manners that Abraham just described are being accomplished by Big Samoan or, you know, other people that come into a room with preferably at least two witnesses and a video camera running, okay? And anybody can do this if they're basically a qualified elector and they've just got an issue that they want to get to the bottom of. If it's a looming court case that they might be involved in, they should probably have somebody more impartial take the point on that and pursue the issue, and they can just be one of the witnesses. You should have at least two witnesses supporting the point man. The point man should be basically a disinterested individual. But
I may add, Charles, that if you're going to move forward on a footing like that, you would have several qualified electors, several town constables, a couple of justices of the peace, some recording equipment, and you would have the right kind of identification and the right kind of costumes so that the entire effect comes to bear, that there is an executive office being brought to bear in that forum that's carrying weight and authority. So the whole thing will come together in an extremely congruent fashion.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a little bit apprehensive that some of our initial activists might not have the five or six people that you're describing. They'll probably be scraping. They might not be able to get two witnesses. It might just be two of them going in there, one of them backing up the other. And there's times where you just do what you can with what you got.
Yeah,
but definitely, Abraham, it would be better to have a good group like that.
Realize the merit of this thing. when people realize the merit of this and they can understand how its constituent components are put together and the presence that it can summon, it would be so formidable. You would have a lot of people who'd want to join in just for the sheer enjoyment of being able to exert that kind of force and finally have an effect that's authoritative. I think you'll have more people than you suspect.
I thirst for days when exactly what you're describing here comes together, Brother Abraham. I think it's important here to reemphasize a point that you did touch on and that I was getting to is have the person that's leading this type of a judicial investigation that's referred to in the Oregon statute would want to have at least extra copies of important documents, at least two important documents there. One would be his identification as a qualified elector and member of the community. And the second would be the written and judicially signed judicial warrant, which has authorized and legitimized the judicial investigation, which he is conducting. And once, like a county clerk or a city clerk or a chief of police or a sheriff, once you put those documents in front of them and other judicial officers, these judicial investigations can be brought to bear against other judicial officers. One judicial officer can review the proceedings of another judicial officer. It has profound implications. But yes, the two documents you would want to have, we need to stand in the light. They're the creatures of darkness. They're the ones that make silent presumptions whereunder they can usurp unjustified authority over our common people. We don't do that. We're at a higher level of law and spiritual and physical world accountability, and we present our personal identification of who the real flesh and blood man or woman is that's conducting this judicial investigation. Right here, staring at you, here's my identification card, and here's my warrant and for conducting this judicial investigation, paper copy of it, signed and sealed by the judicial officer named therein. See what it says there? Want to take a second or two to read it? Yeah, we're here to conduct the judicial investigation. We need you to produce some records and books that you don't normally display to the public, or whatever other issue might be on the table. See, at that point, their lawyers are going to be screaming their hair out, and when the county clerks and the city clerks see the lawyers pulling their hair out, they're going to be inclined to just do what you say, just like Abraham was talking about. So I really think it's important that this general Section 3 of our agenda be comprehended for how much empowerment that we've got access to, and that we are, it's part of our responsible self-governing communities organizing effort here, that we are promoting through these conferences of this Supreme Court of Law. And that's pretty close to a conclusion there. Comments or questions, or anybody want to tell me I'm full of smoke here? I think I'll yield.
I also wanted to, in remembering how that went down in that automotive store, because prior to us, putting this guy in check, he was brazen. He was very adamant about not paying. That he had no reason to pay. He was just very uncooperative. After the Samoan came at him with this process and procedure that he did, I actually felt bad for the business owner, right? Because he was saying, "I'm sorry, I apologize, I didn't mean anything by it," because the Samoan was so convincing, and the way he held that camera up, and the way in which he cited the rules and regulations that applied, and how everything in front of him was going to be recorded and being presented to a judge in a court of law, the guy started backpedaling so quickly I was embarrassed for him. It was so effective, the guy capitulated. Like, he just fell, like a, how does that go? Like a bad deck of cards. He just fell apart from being so formidably opposed to paying us to, oh, whatever you say, whatever you want, just don't take this any further, because it was a very convincing argument that guy made. And he ad-libbed it. It wasn't even rehearsed. Anyway, I just wanted to add that because it was so effective that the guy, I felt bad for him because he became very apologetic and started backpedaling, and it was kind of shameful how quickly he folded. I thought he had more merit to him, as tough as he was sounding prior to this engagement. That's it.
Just Chris has an observation and a question.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, first and foremost, the Samoan obviously had a substantial presence, and he may have, even though he was being armed with knowledge and articulating it with explicit specificity, which was probably intimidating in and of itself, I reasonably suggest that the store welcher probably perceived him to have the present ability to do him egregious bodily harm at the very least.
That's what I thought, because this guy looked very intimidating to begin with, but he was very soft-spoken. Somebody so big and so intimidating to be very soft-spoken. And it really wasn't his intimidating presence, because I was listening and watching. I'm a salesman by nature too, so I watch things around me very carefully. And I was watching him, and he had done this many times before in other situations. And I thought that I could have done it better than he did, and he had done this many times before. Because, you know, being a very well-trained salesman, I thought I could have did it much better with greater presence. And I don't think it was his intimidating size that did it. Because the way in which this owner responded, it was to the merit of what was being said and the presence of that camera and weighing out the facts that everything that he just said could end up in front of the law. In other words, they had several pit bulls behind that counter. And one time before, they threatened to sick the dogs on us. So this was a very volatile situation, which is why we called, just in case it was going to turn into a fight, we brought that big Samoan with us. But after he did what he did, it was so technically cunning. It wasn't so much his big intimidating size as it was the words that he chose and the mannerisms which he demonstrated there that put everybody on edge and made them very fearful that they could all end up in court and end up in trouble, end up in jail. That was really what did it, not the fact that he was a big, strong dude.
Well, he was a formidable multi-level package, and there were a lot of different operant dynamic circumstances at play that urged his voluntary compliance quickly, I'm guessing.
So his big size certainly didn't hurt.
The question I was wanting to ask, Charles in particular, I suggest that I'm perceiving you may be glossing over some of the technicalities of employing the judicial investigation because of the obvious conflicts of the marriage of the investigatorial or executive position married with the judicial capacity seems to offer up some difficulties of itself. However, I suggest the judge may have his investigative arm of his office that would be somewhat separated from the judicial functions, although under his tutelage, guise, and watchful auspices, that could carry out the judicial office functions of investigation without using the judge himself in that capacity. And so I would caution that marriage of two different branches of government creates a potential conundrum there, and not having any separation of powers. But if that's the case, I don't have an issue with it. But otherwise, I would say it needs to have some watchful consideration. Thank you.
Charles, are you here and unmuted?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay, Lewis?
We can now. You got the point.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I lost connection there for a moment. To reply to Chris's excellent focused discussion, and thank you, Abraham, for carrying on with the detailed discussion of the scenario with the Samoan. But Chris, you're drawing out an excellent point that I think perhaps. Ooh, do we got an echo?
I'm muted, so it can't be me.
Well, this is David.
I'm
trying to find out.
David.
Mute.
If you can't find it on the on your if you're dialing in from your phone, you can always use star six.
No, I'm dialing
in through the computer. There should be a microphone.
I think I found a mic, but
okay. If you click on the mic, it'll mute you out.
Wait, this is the new format here. I was having a problem last week too.
I don't want to mute you on this end because I want you to have the ability to unmute yourself. Okay, did we lose David? Did he drop off? I think he's still working with it. So hopefully he'll, looks like he's still on and with screen sharing. Hopefully he'll rejoin us. Charles, I yield.
Okay.
You've got the floor.
Thank you, Lewis. To continue on with the excellent details of technical issues such as separation of powers doctrine that is a confusing factor for probably 80-90% of our attendees here. Even though I have addressed the issue before, it's hard to get that, what I've said, firmly ingrained in the mental pictures that we're carrying of this spiritual battlefield of our mental images of how it's all unfolding. And see, remember I talked earlier about how all the powers at the outer shell grassroots. See, the nature of the municipal government is under separation of powers doctrine. Everything from the county level and smaller is inherently constitutionally empowered to function under common law, which is a higher system of law and is more organically connected to the people than the state and federal level Roman Empire modeled civil municipal governments. And if I might expand just a little bit to shore up that general argument just a little bit, the office of the sheriff in our modern counties. Oregon Blue Book has a citation from the Secretary of State that I've articulated before that says, the American county is based upon the Anglo-Saxon county of England as it existed back around the time of the Norman Conquest, which means before the Norman Conquest, and that's back in 1066 AD. They're under. And that citation continues on to articulate that the word county is of French administrative municipal law derivation. The proper word in Anglo-Saxon terminology for the county is the shire. Okay, and there's no separation of powers here, and you can still look up sheriff's courts on the internet. There's still a few remnants of them in England, and there was things like that in early America, and that is technically what is referred to in Oregon statutes as the county court. And many others, that the county court, or more properly termed the sheriff's court, is the county level jurisdiction where 1,000 qualified electors are supposed to be able to come together based upon the Exodus 18 hierarchy that we've referenced before. And that authority of the sheriff, the reeve of the shire. The reeve means reverend supreme officer, common law monarch, for the captains referred to in Exodus 18, captains of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. He's the captain of the thousand group of community there. That's the shire reeve. That's the sheriff. Most sheriffs now don't know that on their common law side jurisdiction, they possess the judicial power. They've been brainwashed by the Roman Empire civil municipal propaganda to think that they're only executive officers and they got to rely on the de facto courts to tell them what to do and how to do it. They can run their own courts. They just don't know. We can point that out to them. Here under, at the precinct level, same conditions exist. We've got the tradition referenced in the Bible of the Roman centurion. I dare say the Israelites were doing the same thing, just grassroots, bottom up, rather than a franchise from the Roman Empire, as the centurions are listed. But those same 100 court officers, 100 men are referred to, justice of the peace in our modern American common law terminology. These justice of the peace judicial officers, chief officers of the judicial court, they have the judicial and the executive power, and the so-called legislative power comes along as a ragtag shirt tail adopted red-haired stepchild of the inherent judicial power, which in common law carried the legislative power with it. So all of those concepts, legislative, executive, and judicial, are inherent in the office of the sheriff. They're in, and under similar terminology, if you want, the county judge. And at the precinct level, it's inherent of the office of the justice of the peace, which is your general jurisdiction judicial officer. And these are what are referred to in the Sixth Amendment to the Federal Constitution as having criminal jurisdiction. In other words, authority to execute the death penalty right there in your own local precinct. If you deem it is justified, your jury says so. You can do things like that if the case warranted and your jury unanimously agreed. And as the shell, again, repeating the theme, like the eggshell, as closer you get to the grassroots, the more empowerment you've got. The town constables, they've got the right to be assertive and to make presumptions in the manner in which they're flashing their guns and badges in their own local townships and in coordination with the other town constables around them. And if they might overassert their authority at some point, any time in the future, then appeal can be made to their judicial officers to rein them in. That's what the judiciary is an afterthought. It really is all the power at the grassroots level with the town constables. And there is no separation of powers. They're just like an inferior judicial officer at the town constable level there, Brother Chris. What we're talking about here is such a game changer that we're putting serious, aggressive horsepower into the hands of the individual town constables and the Justice of the Peace judicial officers at the precinct level to issue letters authorizing these judicial investigations. But those letters could very appropriately be addressed to somebody that signed both the qualified elector and the town constable oath form. At that point, you'd have the status of your town constable, peace officer, conducting this very, very powerful, quote, judicial investigation. And certainly even the individual qualified electors can do that. I hope that little rant there might shed a little bit more light on your concern and minimize it, your concern about respecting separation of powers doctrine. Again, that doctrine is not a common law doctrine. It's a Roman Empire civil municipal doctrine, and it does not apply in our counties, precincts, and townships. Could you reply, Chris, if my words seem to you to be an error, or perhaps we have agreement there?
Well, I certainly appreciate your eloquent and encompassing elucidation there. I am always very familiar with the Shire, the Reed, and the original concepts. However, observing some of the misuse and disuse of what's taken place these days by having people with less than right minds and moral upstanding character infiltrating the law enforcement services and institutions, so-called, of the agencies around the Americas, has brought to me an ever-present awareness and critical analytical assessment that makes it very dangerous when others outside the local areas infiltrate and undermine and seditiously conspire to pervert it to their own self-interest. And this is where the discretionary line of the law enforcement official or the sheriff or his constabulary, if you will, abusing their office for their own self-serving period or political adverse interest becomes a very serious consideration. And we must have right-minded, moral-thinking people with Christian ideals as opposed to some other ideals around the world that are not quite as refined, if you will, as our American system had grown to be at one time, but has radically deviated from in the present sense, in my observation and experience firsthand, regrettably. You know, I am a former multi-jurisdictional law enforcement professional and have, you know, I've always been pretty key in adhering to those principles. Not perfect, and I may have had a couple of incidences in my life where I could have been a little more open-minded, and but I've also had compliments from people that I had the unfortuitous duty to arrest on different occasions and appreciated and thanked me for the way I conducted myself and with them instead of being administering field justice and discipline, if you will. Tried to conduct myself in a professional, respectful manner, considering the rights of all people to be paramount and important, and the office only to be a an authorization to carry it out with a measured meeting out of those things only when called for by the circumstances. And you can change the circumstances, but you cannot change the consequences of those circumstances if you abuse your discretion. And with that, I thank you very, very much for giving it such tender treatment.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Yes, that your background is excellent, and actually that tone that you're setting about respectful and no extra, no force more than whatever's necessary is the exact type of peacekeeping attitude that these sorts of judicial investigations would need to employ and would need to permeate all of our activities in response our efforts at establishing our own responsibly self-governing communities. I think I've basically concluded my presentation here, but I would like to indulge in a little bit more comments and questions about the powerful issues that we've discussed. And then David Scheid, I'm glad you're here. I think right after we conclude agenda item 3 here, we can get into a 5 or 10 minute presentation of the current developments in your case, if that sounds good, Brother David there.
That sounds fine.
Okay, thank you, David. Comments or questions about the boldly empowering propositions that I'm posturing as being the cold, hard, lawful reality of the cosmic chessboard that we can assume greater power on here. Anybody see any defects, especially in what I'm saying, please point them out. I if I'm in error, I want to know about it. But I've studied these issues for quite a while, and I don't think I'm in error on what I'm saying here. Comments, questions, criticisms, anybody? I would like to, before I turn loose of this subject agenda, I'd like to reemphasize what Abraham is bringing to the table here, because especially in light of Chris's concerns about the normal municipal franchisees of executive authority. They've got their own preconceived notions about what's lawful and what's not. And what we're talking about doing to empower the people here, especially in concerns of judicial investigations, this is going to be messing with their well-settled comprehension of how real law works. But as Abraham was illustrating here, okay, when you walk in the door with your group of people and the video camera's running, okay, and your words are well chosen and they are citing, Abraham talked about the Samoan citing statutes or codes or authority of law. See, when our people proceed similarly as that example that Abraham cited, by citing law on the record in front of witnesses and a video camera, then you can see the wheels turning in the brains of the people that are behind the desk and potential opposition. They're doing mental calculations. They're running it through their computer. Gee whiz, what are the odds that I'm going to be able to smoke and mirrors my way out of this unexpected confrontation here? And they do the math. They do it quickly, calculating real fast there. And after about 3, 4, 5 seconds of ums and ahs and pausing and stuttering, they go, 95% of the chances, I do believe, are that they're going to be, well, okay, what is it particular you want to investigate? And we'll start proceeding along exactly what the agenda is needed here. I believe, just like Abraham said, we will obtain compliance in 95% of the cases just because we've engineered the confrontation in a strategic manner. And so last call for comments, questions, critiques before we move on. Anybody? Anybody? These are bold propositions. You know, they could change the whole government of the whole USA right here by getting a firm handle on this judicial power and decentralizing it down to our common people through this judicial investigation authority of anybody with a note from their local Justice of the Peace precinct captain. Last call. Comments, questions? Hearing none. Bringing closure to agenda item 3. And reverting back to agenda item 2, David Schott, would you like to assume the floor, take the microphone here, and explain current updates with your case here?
Well, I just sent out a blast of emails. I've got apparently some bad email addresses. What I sent out to Nikki and to Lewis both came back to me today, and so I think that everything went through with Charles, and I don't have the email addresses of Abe, of Chairman Matt, of Chris Cave, really anybody else on the line here that I see. And so I will ask, as I ask in the email, that you know, that this be forwarded to the appropriate places. But it's 168 pages. It's divided into 4 emails so that the number of megabytes do fit in with the email attachment. And it's chock full of evidence. And it's a case that that I've been going through since 2003. It shows bottom to top in government of Washtenaw County. This particular email deals with Washtenaw County. Bottom to top of corruption, racketeering, and domestic terrorism. And I've defined all of those, and I've proven them. And it happens to even get into the clerk's office of Washtenaw County, which happens to be tied in with the elections. And so I've proven it. It's on the table. If anybody wants to adjudicate it, it shows that the courts, as we are seeing right now, are determining there's no facts. You know, if there's no facts, that nobody can prove that there's any you know, election fraud, despite that the proof is out there, the proof is being just like in my case, nobody is considering nobody of any power position. Let me put it this way. No government functionary is opening their eyes to their and taking their blinders off to see the facts, yet they are conclusory statements and summarily saying that there's no facts to be found. Therefore, they can't adjudicate any kind of a ruling that is in the favor of these so-called Trumpers. You know, so I've basically been experiencing all the same stuff for the last 17 years, and I've been very meticulous on my documentation to prove all of this stuff, and that's the status of it of today. What it is it amounts to this progressivism, this need for diversity and all this stuff amounts to you know, treason against the Constitution, sedition, because nobody is autocracy and you know, socialism and criminal behavior, you know, and I can prove it, and I'm just calling it out. I give them 5 minutes.
Thank you, David. Comments or questions in response to David's presentation there from anybody?
This is Nikki. And Nikki. David, did I hear you say that you tried to send to me and I did not receive it?
Yeah, it seemed that my email, when I sent it to Juno, there was a Nikki Hanovig at Juno.com. It seemed to be the only thing that popped up when I looked for your name in my email book, and it all came back to me.
Yeah, probably because of the size of what you try to send. Is there any way that you could go ahead and just drop the attachment into the chat area here for me and just go ahead and email what was in the email itself?
Oh, you know, that's a good idea. So let me see what I can do.
It might work for Lewis, too.
Yeah, well, or anybody else that's on the line here.
Okay, thank you, David.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do I drop it?
In the chat. Just open the chat.
All right, hold on here.
Open the chat, and you'll see a paperclip.
Okay, so it's not that. Chat. That's the round one. Okay, oval. Okay. Yeah. So what do I do? I just
Just drag and drop. Drop it into where the paperclip is. You see the paperclip?
I don't see a paperclip. I'm in the chat. Thank you, everybody, for bearing with me here.
Down at the bottom.
Yeah.
Okay. And it says everyone. Do you see that?
It says all participants.
Okay, whatever it says on yours. And then you see the paperclip? You can just drag it and drop it.
I don't see a paperclip. I see a smiley face, and it says use the tab key to insert emoji, and then it says type the message here, but I don't see a paperclip.
To the left of it? Just drag and drop it and see if it works.
Okay. All right, I'll work on that.
Okay, mine shows up. Mine shows a paperclip to the left of the emoji.
Nope, I don't see any paperclip to the left of the emoji on mine.
But that's okay. Just drag and drop and see what happens.
I will do that. All right, and give me about 5 minutes, sir. Thanks.
Hey, David, what's your email?
My email address is D as in David, E as in eggnog. Here, I'll type it into the chat.
Well, that's not going to... I'm not on the chat. You got to give it to me.
Oh, okay. D as in David, E as in eggnog, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, H as in Happy, I as in Igloo, E as in Edward, D as in David. So it's DESCHIED at yahoo.com.
Okay, it just so happens I have it. So it's like it came up on my... And I'll just put Washington on. In fact, I'm going to put A2 in the subject line. That's for Ann Arbor. And I'll just send you a blank. I'll send you a blank email, which I just sent. And
perfect.
You can send it back to me. That way you'll have my email, too.
And who's this?
This is Matt in Michigan.
Matt.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I'll definitely send you what it comes in four parts. And I'll look for that email. Thank you.
Thank you.
And David, this is Lewis. What email address did you send that to? That you said it bounced back from?
Well, this is going to take me a while because I.
Okay, no worries. I don't want to put you out and interrupt what you're doing right now to get that out. So we'll touch base later.
You have my email address. Why don't you send me an email? Mine hadn't changed, but if send me an email and I'll... Oh, it was a Proton. I remember it was Proton Mail that I sent it to.
It may be a size issue there, yeah. Go with the Lou Hammond. If you have a mic.
Okay. I have that Lou Hammond at Gmail?
Yeah, that's never changed.
Okay, so I'll try that one next. Just so everybody knows, I was trying to keep everything under 25 megabytes. I know that Yahoo doesn't go over 25, and it's kind of a standard, you know. So if you've got, I know Charles was having, with the constitutionalgov.us, I would send out stuff all the time, and his was the only one that ever came back, and it just didn't go up to 25 megabytes, and I think anybody who doesn't have an email that has 25 megabytes needs to be in it. You know, that's too small. It really is. Let me get this. I'll get it out. I'll mute myself. Thank you. Any other questions, I'll take them.
I would like to just briefly say, David, that I can post those new files in your same general directory that we've already got on constitutionalgov.us for your case, so that thereunder you can just send people web links to where it's at instead of...
I'm not doing that anymore, and you know all the reasons why, but I also have not, since I lost my legs and my fingers, I have not had access to, we've never been able to work out that... being able to upload thing, being able to do any changes myself since, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, Charles. I'll mute.
Right. When we get a budget, we'll be able to do that. I was just volunteering my ability to make the files, the big files, more accessible to the people. Am I correct that you don't want my assistance in that area?
Oh, no, no. If you want to put them up, that's fine. I'm just...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Okay.
Okay. I'll I don't know. It's not, to me, it's not a new case. This case has been going on since 2003. So, it's not really a new case per se. So I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly where the best place to put it right now. I think that you've got a different subcategory, dealing with some of your stuff. If you want to put it up there, that's fine. That way you can put it.
David, I'm going to keep all of your stuff under your directory for all of your cases.
Okay.
If I'm going to continue helping you here, I like being able to help you here, but I don't have a budget, I don't have computer tech support, and I can only do so much to help you, and I got to do it my way.
There you go. Go ahead. That's good.
Thank you. So is there any other comments or questions on the effort that David Scheid is putting together here from anybody? Hearing none, I guess we can proceed on to agenda item 4, which is a revisit of the economic issues that we briefly touched on in our last conference before we turned the conference over to the very enchanting discussion with Michael's friend, Joe Giribaldi, I believe, something like that, from Florida there, that has the profound projects with the very clean deep level water supply there in Florida, helping all the people there. We rather introduced his resources that he's bringing to the community to help with alternative economic empowerment. And I'm rather raising this issue of economics higher in our general list of agenda items. Like now it's agenda item 4, right after the main introductory issue, because we're all concerned about building our numbers, okay, and building our communities, building our numbers, building our participants in these conferences, and building the people that are willing to support our sign on and support our jury verdicts, willing to sign the qualified electors' oath of offices, things like that. And while we can appeal to issues of justice and peace and security and accountability in elections, that frequently only appeals to a small minority of the population. However, this agenda item 4 concerning economic issues, that hits the guts clearly of a majority, a significant majority, probably 80-90% of our population, okay? Everybody is motivated by concerns for their economic security. And so here under, I'd like to delve into a little bit less rushed review of economic issues, and I can see we're right at the top of the hour here. I should pause here for a few brief comments or questions about where we're going with the economic issues, which I'll try to set the tone for in the after call. We're going to have to conclude our business meeting right here, but I would like to take at least 10 minutes or so to briefly outline these economic concerns in our after call, and then we can enter into more fluid and open discussion. Comments or questions briefly about the economic issues that we're talking about here?
Charles, this is Chris.
When we had the call last week with Joe, it was, let's call it introductory, and I had been at a loss for the site for Deborah Tavares that I had suggested might be on the same trail of primary water that he was speaking of, and her site is stopthecrime.net, and she also has some very critical documents on there, the Iron Mountain Report, Silent Weapons or Quiet Wars, and quite a few others that are very helpful for understanding what's going on here in America and around the world today. For anybody that wants to take a look, she also has a very strong presence on YouTube, if it hasn't been taken down, probably on BitChute, under her name, Deborah Tavares, stopthecrime.net. She's sort of like Amazing Polly, if anybody here on this call is aware of her work as an investigative journalist of the highest order, connecting the dots of the global takeover plans and the Great Reset that we hear so much about, of Klaus Schwab and his, let's call them economic maniacs at Davos. So with that, that's what I had for you, and I thank you for letting me share the information, unless someone has a question.
Thank you, Chris. I do know Deborah Tavares' work, and she is a very talented woman. She does have a lot of beautiful resources, like the report from Iron Mountain that you mentioned, which is foundational to comprehending the conspiracy here. And as you articulated, she has done research on this primary deep source water that Joe was talking about. So she's a really talented woman. And it kind of sounded like Joe was unaware of her. And we should try to cross-pollinate these people. It'd be great if we could get Deborah Tavares to communicate directly with us or something, and especially if she could compare notes with Joe. Maybe that they're both busy people. I'm just fantasizing. But yes, are there further comments on or questions about Deborah Tavares or Chris's comments or these economic issues before we draw the conference, the business section of our conference, to a close here? Anyone? Hearing none. This is the conclusion of the formal business meeting of the Supreme Court of Law for the United States of America, as we exist in our humble beginnings here. This is a nice little group. We've had smaller than this before, and I think slowly and steady we are building a constituency, of good quality people. Quality is more important than quantity, my friends. And I am proud to declare my belief that we've got some real prime, super-duper quality in our attendees here. And, our formal business meeting is hereby brought to a close. And at this point, I think I should open it again to comments or questions, but I would like to move on with a little bit more of a conclusion on the economic issues after we ask for comments or questions at this juncture, definitely more open discussion after I conclude a decent follow-up to my fixation on economic issues there. So are there any further comments or questions at this point? Anybody? Hearing none. Let me continue on with the importance of at least primary issue 4A. This is a game changer that I at least briefly touched on in a bit of a rush as we were trying to get to Joe here in our last conference. The fact that the economic currency, the source of the credit that people, that our constituency should be allowed to circulate amongst the people of America, is each of our qualified electors at the grassroots level of our community organizing. And we could go even lower than that. We could be inviting people in to the alternative economic system and registering them with a line of credit if they seem to be basically honorable people that have the potential to eventually become qualified electors. People that are critical of our qualified elector and common law self-governing community process, I think they need to stay with the Federal Reserve banking system and the evil empire economy. But I think our alternative economic system could go out to even non-qualified electors, people that are uncomfortable taking the commitment, signed that two-page qualified elector oath of office. We don't need to have that in order to advance this alternative economic system to people. And they're under. We are bringing the source of the credit from that circulates as money in our alternative economic system will be the individual participants in the alternative economic system that we are promoting. See, everyone would be promising to deliver goods or services that is participating, and they're under reasonable promotion or proportion to the goods and services that they are promising to deliver. They are receiving an allocation of community credit from their local town constable or their local precinct level justice of the peace. They are receiving an allocation of credit that they can use in local community currency and maybe even farther up the hierarchy in national and planetary community currency. These ideas are stand in stark contrast to the current situation. Bitcoin is a centrally planned thing. It's got a center of gravity of its own, but it's not controlled by the grassroots and the Federal Reserve banking system. It's definitely centralized. They're talking about a great reset to move to an international currency and things like this. Corbett Report, James Corbett did a real good report on YouTube about that within the last week or so, where they're talking about a new Bretton Woods agreement, which the old one during World War II decided economic issues and how centrally planned economies would be run. And they're talking about it as a new Bretton Woods economic agreement that is coming at us here. These are big issues on the table. We need to be buckling our safety belts and making preparations for the manner in which the de facto economic system is evolving, because it's evolving to our detriment. They're going to eliminate cash. They're going to be able to track every single transaction that occurs within their system and control it and limit it, just like the Babylonian whore described in the biblical book of Revelation, where nobody will be able to buy or sell anything without the mark of the beast. That's what they're moving towards. But if we, even Bitcoin and alternative currency things could provide some degree of options to that, but they're all goofy. And people that are doing other alternative economic systems in the latter parts of the last conference, I kind of debated with John Root to over an hour well about John Root and most other people are talking about some type of centralized system like run by the Communist Party or something where bureaucrats are making decisions about how much economic resources people are receiving. See, the system that we're talking about here that is harmonious with common law principles, it's all decentralized right down to the township community consensus building process. That is where is decided how many people are contributing how much and in proportion to what they are contributing within reason and addressing people's needs and having a social safety net type thing, minimal standard of living that the township generally assumes. But people that are way more productive than other people, those people that are way more productive, they need to be receiving higher lines of credit from the community treasury. We have to incentivize people. That was something that John Root and I really differed on. So I just wanted to expand on those economic issues a bit there. And I think I've done pretty good in explaining my lingering concerns. And I think I should pause and open up for comments or questions on from.
This is David. I've got to go back to the earlier agenda item, so I guess I'll call this a point of order. I have tried since I muted myself. I've been I had to go because I'm on a different computer. I downloaded the files that the four different files that I sent. And as soon as I tried to transfer one of them into that that drop of the chat, I was disconnected altogether from the conference. I've come back in. I don't have any other means to do anything. I don't want to be sending out one after another email, you know, because this is four different emails for every person, and so that's why I sent out a group email. I did get the AAAA or A2 from Matt and Lewis. I can send those out, if Charles cannot, he's got copies of these files. If he doesn't send them out or if he can't drop them into the box here, I noticed that we've already lost about, I think, four people since I first brought this to the table. We'll just call it a day on that. So, you know, I just have done the best that I can to present it, and I presented it, and I'll take care of the rest before tomorrow, and I thank everybody for letting me bring it to the table. I yield.
Thank you, David. Are there any comments or questions on either David Scheid's points or my recent comments on economic issues? Hearing none. Okay. I think at that point we can go to open discussion. Does anybody have anything that is just their own personal concern that they would like to express? Anybody?
I suppose I could drop on the call here that going back to the Obama election periods, black box voting was a good resource of intel back then, although there are other things called True the Vote and so on and so forth, different groups that are advocating for honest election systems. And we apparently have been deprived in many areas, maybe not across the board, but in population centers seems to be their focus of targeted antics, if you will, or tampering with the elections. And this is very, very dangerous to freedom and liberty, and our country's in a well of a mess. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chris. Further comments or questions? Is Paul Nally still with us? My glasses. I don't see Paul. I think we lost Paul. I can't help but think that the manner in which Paul has got his complaint on these issues formatted for a federal grand jury, that our court might be able to fill the vacuum there. It seems like, from what I recall Paul saying, there the federal grand jury is not responding. It sounds like that might be construable as obstruction of justice in the federal courts. Because Paul's not getting any answer, and he's raising some important issues here, and they're under, I think that's a prime opportunity for our humble little Supreme Court of Law for the USA to step on the stage and fill the vacuum that's apparently quite present in addressing, I'm sure, what are well-articulated issues by Paul Nally and the 40 other that are signatory to their general complaint before that federal grand jury. Do y'all have any comments or questions about that proposition? I yield.
Just Chris would add that I have seen some indications. It's too soon to conclude yet, but it's been about 14 days since I, or maybe 13 or so, since I mailed my complaint along with my $400 check to the Oklahoma, which is Congress's court under 28 U.S.C. 132 specifically, and they have yet to confirm, respond, answer, or docket from what I can see. Although I haven't had the ability to check online, it does cause me some concern, and Paul's experience suggests that there might be a pattern in practice evincing itself that the federal courts, which have very likely have been taken over by the International Monetary Fund, along with the DOJ and the FBI and the Secretary of State's office, may be obstructing justice, and we may be a fairly eviscerated of our Republican form of government, in my observation, and that would be very troubling in my view.
Thank you, Chris. Is there other comments or questions on these issues? Hearing none. Well, I'm inclined to proceed on to agenda item 5, enforcement for judgments of our Supreme Court.
I finally found my unmute button. Yeah, I just wanted to come into that to say that, this is David. I've been to the U.S. Supreme Court with 5 different cases. I've at least written it well enough to get it to the clerk's office and to do everything that the state of Texas has just done to get theirs dismissed by the Supreme Court. With that said, I have my cases, all 5 of them, did make a confrontation of the facts, as I always do, base it on evidence, and the U.S. Supreme Court is exactly the way you described. They are complacent. They know it exists. They aren't doing anything about it. There is no checks and balances on any other branch of government, they're in malfeasance, and I have posted a video to that effect on a website, Power Corrupts Again, I've recently had some problems with that in because of WordPress updating, but so I'm not sure if that's, I haven't had time to go back to that to make sure that it's up and running, but I did create a video back around 2011 that showed that I am calling out, I was then calling out Eric Holder and all of the U.S. Supreme Court justices, being the executive branch and the judicial branch of crimes of treason, sedition, and everything else, a domestic terrorist. And I yield.
Thank you, David. I'm glad you so articulately summarized that bottleneck, that institutionalized obstruction of justice that is routinely transpiring under the federal de facto municipal Supreme Court. Yes, it's important that more than one voice affirm that is the reality of the situation, especially in these recorded phone conferences, which are intended to function as a court of public record. You hear that, you de facto U.S. Supreme Court judges? We're accusing you of obstructing justice. And we're talking about moving into the vacuum because you are too either incompetent, a.k.a. stupid, or else you're corrupted and you're routinely obstructing things like Paul Nally's, we presume, well-worded petition to the grand jury. That's on your feet. That's at your front door. And it's got to change. The American people aren't going to take it anymore. We got the right to alter, reform, or abolish our government, just like Nikki routinely reminds us. And we're going to be doing that because it's obvious that you're entrenched in either your stupidity or your corruption. It don't matter which. We got to bring about changes because you are not responsive to the organic body politic needs of our common people on the record. And FBI and DOJ agents that are listening in to this conversation and recording it for yourselves, why don't you just go ahead and point that out to those Supreme Court judges? Just relay it on over there. Bring it to their attention, okay? Ask them what we should do about that because they're the Supreme Judicial Officers. If you think we're doing something wrong, you ask them how you low-level grunts should be responding lawfully to what we're doing. If you want to send somebody to jail, start with me, Charles Stewart. I live in Coleman, Texas. Anyway, proceeding there under. Thank you, David. And what were we talking about before that? I was going on to agenda item 5. Any other comments in response to David, or can I continue on over to agenda item 5?
No comments in response to that, but before I forget about this, there was a book called The Judge's Book, and it was put together by, I want to say, Robert Kelly from American's Bulletin. It's about an inch thick, and I had a copy of it long time ago. I won't go into the details about why I don't have a copy of it now, but I had a copy of it long time ago. And in that book, it had a section in it where some government official was talking about recording things at the County Register of Deeds office. And what he put in there was, if they, meaning us, were able to record whatever it was at all 83 County Register of Deeds offices, and I'm talking about Michigan now because there's 83 counties here, it would have taken effect. Now, that's pretty powerful stuff when it's coming from them saying what this can do. So I'm looking for a copy of that book. And if I can get my hands on it, then I'll be happy to go ahead and study this over and see exactly what it was we can record at all county recorders' offices to go ahead and take effect. There's nothing I would like better than to find, to be able to go ahead and take an issue that's near and dear to us and then formulate it into something in writing and then record it at every county office in the state and the registered deeds office in the state, and at that point it would take effect. And when I first became aware of this, the recording fees in Michigan were $14 for the first page and $1 for each additional page. Well, since then, they've changed it to where it's $30 flat fee, whether it's one piece of paper or 100. So it's not cost prohibitive anymore. It's going to be about $2,500 to do Michigan. And then plus, of course, you've got to drive to all the 83 counties to go ahead and do it. So if anybody has that book or knows of it, it was about, like I said, it was about an inch thick, 8.5 by 11. And it was essentially, if somebody took an inch thick of copies that they would put through a regular copy machine and then spiral bound it with one of those black plastic spiral bounds, that's what the book looked like. And the front of it said the judge's book. And it was, I'm going back to the late 90s, I want to say, was when it when I first got my hands on it. So we're talking like it's a 20-year-old book, but it'd still be good to get get back into circulation if we could find a copy of it. So with that, thank you.
I may have that book on my desktop. I also had the federal judge's bench book for the courts of appeals, and I can assure you that there was a application for bar membership in the back of that particular document. And so that tells us the bar has taken unlawful control and has become a tyrannical government running the complete judicial system. And I have read, and I'm not convinced it's not true, that the federal judges may get paid in gold by the IMF. And so, effectively, our government has been occupied and seditiously undermined, I think, in my esteemed assessment. Thank you.
Yes, this is Cynthia. I would like to comment on that because my last document that I sent out, you, I am challenging off of the Supreme Court, and I found out exactly what they say, that we only have like one court, that is the International Court. But they're also corrupted. We are facing right now a situation with the whole system. They're all in bed together. This was the whole plan that they talk about, what J.F. Kennedy talked about when he said that it's a plot against to enslave every man, woman, and child. And I'm going to expose this before I leave this high and mighty office. That's what he was talking about. So what we are dealing with is a total corrupted system, from the very top to the bottom. So you're absolutely right, and a lot of them now are being prosecuted for some of these things, like Clarence Thomas, John Roberts, a lot of them right now at the Supreme Court. And that's what's in my last document that I sent out in Georgetown to let them know. And I also put Malcolm X in there as well, because Malcolm X made a comment many years ago when he said, "Why keep running to the fox? If your government has failed you, and if you realize that someone has failed you, you need to stop entertaining yourself to that." Then he also said, "Stop running from the fox to the wolf, because if you're a sheep, they're going to eat you anyway, or a chicken, or whatever." So that's what we're facing right now, and that's why we're doing this small community court system ourselves, because we're going to hear a lot of things after December, of a lot of things taking place, and a lot of arrest warrants are taking place as well. And we are preparing ourselves for these changes, because just like we're doing our own society, our own court, and situations like that, because when you take away something, you're going to have to replace it. So we're like on the right track. But yes, our government, the whole system is corrupted, the total system, and we're going to have to start having our own for justice for humanity, because these entities are not really what we say contract with this, what we call Mother Earth. But that's another story. But yes, the whole system is corrupted. The whole system is. and we're making a change now to go back to what we call common law, but we're going to really natural law. I yield.
Thank you, Cynthia. And thank you, Chris, and thank you, I believe it was David or Matt also in there. Other comments or questions, anybody? Hearing none, I would like to pursue agenda item 5 a little bit, which is discussing enforcement. I think my text here is well manicured. I think I can just read it. Critiques of the bold propositions presented in other agenda items will likely be inclined to view these propositions as the insane rantings of delusional people who are not capable of amounting any realistic enforcement of the judgments of our Supreme Court or smaller courts. Indeed, this precise issue is frequently the pivot point in whether or not support will be gained from people who show some interest in these bold ideas. We here intend to answer this concern about lack of enforcement by citing both constitutions and statutes, state and federal, which clearly affirm the common right of our American people to organize our own trusted peace officers from the grassroots and upwards through local township, precinct, and counties, and hereunder lawfully empowering our grassroots activists to enforce all warrants which the unanimous juries of our common law judicial court system might find to be necessary and justified in order to preserve the peace and safety of our common American people. Our lawful basis for exercising these profoundly important peacekeeping power is explained in extensive detail in the last two of the three web links presented here in the agenda item 5A, and therein citing starting townships, how to start our township communities, and our Building Self-Governing Communities document, and the citations in support of building self-governing communities. And there is further discussion that I'm inclined to pursue here a little bit. If I've got an audience and nobody else wants to compete for the microphone, I'd like to build on that just a little bit. But again, I like to frequently take breaks so that everybody feels that they're getting plenty of opportunity to tell Charles Stewart that he's blowing smoke. If anybody wants to get in my face about anything I'm saying or to make other comments or questions here, the floor is open. Anybody wants to grab the microphone and sing and dance a little bit, please do so. I yield. Hearing none. Anybody? Hearing none. I'd like to point out statutes in virtually every state in the union, probably. I'll be surprised if it's not every state in the union, even including Louisiana, recognizes the right to what is called, quote, citizen's arrest, unquote. Okay? And I dare suggest that's a massive, massive, massive power decentralizing statute, source of law, lawful authority. Okay? They recognize the right of citizens' arrest. They aren't even public servants. Our town constables are public servants. Oregon statute, I believe it is, maybe Colorado or Texas. I know I've seen at least one statute that recognizes wording that when any individual exercises a citizen's arrest, they have a duty to take the arrested person to the nearest peace officer or judicial officer. Okay? That's the only way a citizen's arrest is lawful, is if the person being arrested is immediately and responsibly delivered to a public servant, even if it's only an executive officer, commonly interpreted like a local town constable. And that's because of accountability, because otherwise it's just the citizen acting on his own. If he's delivering it to a higher judicial authority, then it's not anarchy. It's subject to overriding law. There is lawful superior authority that citizen making the citizen's arrest is subjecting himself to, and there under his presumption is that he is acting lawfully. Okay? And there's other statutes at the next higher level. When these statutes say that it's unlawful, it's a separate crime to resist arrest by a peace officer. It's not a separate crime to resist a citizen's arrest, but it is a separate crime, according to some statutes anyway, to resist arrest by a peace officer. Okay? And so even higher authority is given to your town constable, because your town constable is statutorily recognizable as a peace officer. That's how it fits together. He's not only statutorily recognizable as a peace officer, he is a peace officer under common law jurisdiction. So with that higher authority of the town constable peace officer that might be making the arrest or receiving the arrest from the arrestee from a citizen, that town constable, according to the statute, articulating common law principles, the town constable has a duty, as soon as reasonably possible, to bring the arrested person before a judicial officer. The tradition is within 24 hours for the judicial officer to summarily ascertain whether or not there truly is probable cause to believe that the arrested person has committed the crime, and if so, to take the appropriate action of either incarcerating him or securing some sort of a bail that can reasonably assure his appearance in court proceedings, which under common law jurisdiction, where we have lots of grassroots courts, ready and waiting for cases to come, prompt and efficient administration of justice in the local jurisdictions. That's the whole common law plan, as well as biblical Torah law plan. They're under. When the town constable brings the USD before the judicial officer says, "Hey, well, looks like we've got probable cause to believe you committed a crime, and apparently you're flat broke, you can't post bail, and I think we can get our jury together within 48 hours here. We're going to keep you for a couple of days here in our local jail, and we'll get a jury, and we'll get to the bottom of it. We'll do some investigation from witnesses here. We'll get potential jurors right on it from the local community here, and we'll figure out whether or not there's any merits to what prompted your arrest here and the accusation behind it. Why don't you just cool your heels there in our jail cell for a couple of days, and we'll get to the bottom of this in a real quick and efficient manner." And thereunder, the local responsibly self-governing community has authority to use force and to point guns at people, anybody that might be breaching the peace in their precinct or township community, okay? It's like I was talking about earlier, it's like an egg. The real hard issues are on the outside of the shell with the local town constables and the local justice of the peace and the qualified electors that are acting as an organic body politic harmonious with their competently elected and organically accountable judicial and executive officers, the town constables and the judicial officer, justice of the peace there. So that is the sovereignty at the precinct level when you've got the judicial power functioning and the town constables exercising the executive power. That is the complete enchilada for exercising the sovereignty as a free and independent nation state. And the county at the next higher level is merely an association of these sovereign, fully sovereign, self-governing precincts, judicially accountable precincts. And the counties they're under going to the state level, the counties are similar associations. The state is merely an assembly of the responsibly self-governing counties. And so it's all grassroots accountable. It's all percolating bottom up for keeping the peace and purging the criminal elements from each of these responsibly self-governing communities. And then, so I think at that point we should conclude reading from the agenda items. Is there further discussion on this last issue of enforcement and the town constables and citizens' arrest?
Yes, I would like to say something about that. What you're saying is really true, but this is not reality to the majority of the people. And so when we transition into something like that, we're going to have to use also, because if I right now, I can say what the law is about, but if I go arrest somebody and they don't even look at me as an authority figure, that's going to be a problem. So we're going to have reality with this. If we have like the Amish people have their own community already set up or organized, they can't come in our community and do certain things. And then we could do that. But we can't just not go out into the public and say someone is, I think when that can be done, things like that will gradually happen as we transition and people be more aware of some people don't even know that they're enslaved by the court system. They believe in the court system. And they do not look at us as peace officers. And if, like right now, if I had a community, like this community where I live at, was totally engraved like the Amish, yes, I can control that, and it's going to take step after step. But this when you're talking like that organization has to be set up, because it would be such you don't want bloodshed for the a situation that can be handled. What we have to look at when we start doing that is how aware the people out there about this movement as well, and educating them with that, and how well structured our community is to do something like that. But just right now, for me to say, even though that's the law, I'm going to go out there and do that, that will be a very dangerous thing to do, and it would be, I think, malice. It would be, you have to have a plan, and you have to have your organization set up for that to go towards it, because a certain way you're going to have to do things to transition into that point, and less bloodshed for our brothers and sisters that's ignorant to that point, and they have to be knowledgeable about it. So it's about making the public aware of some of these things and stuff like that, and getting our situation organized before you just go out there and start saying, oh, this is the law. And you're dealing with people alive, you're talking about guns, you're talking about all these other stuff. But it's a way that we're going to have to handle that, and that's when the group get together and see what they have on the table to organize this group to become efficient for that, so we can also handle this in the most peaceful manner that you possibly can, but also transition so that we can get our freedom back. I yield.
Thank you. Thank you, Sister Cynthia. I'm glad you drew out that point about we want to be responsible, and we don't want to just take these ideas and run with them. That's part of why we're here in conference, so that we can talk about the practical applications of these profoundly empowering lawful authorities that are at our fingertips here. We don't want any crazy ideas like this blowing up in our face and causing more harm than good. I think it's important to remember Abraham's example of the Samoan that is coming in there with a camera and witnesses and law and citing statutes such as what I just talked about for citizens' arrest and things like that. When we have it organized with a group of people and everything's being video recorded, at that point, then we can go ahead and start presuming that we might be ready to go ahead and start doing some practical application in the real world. But the wise course would definitely be, as I believe you're inferring, Cynthia, to if it's just each, individuals of us that are hearing these things, don't go trying these things yourself. Wait until you've got some type of a community of people. This is why you need to be going to churches or bars or shopping centers or wherever God is inspiring you to go to communicate with people that might be similarly concerned about you as you about God's holy justice on this earth. When you can find a few more people like that, then you've got opportunity to build community with them, wherein you support them in their issues and they support you in yours. At that point, you've got your trust community, your basic township community coming together, and you've got your second witnesses that can assist you, that can run your video camera when you're doing the confrontation or when they're doing the confrontation. You can run the video camera for them and be their second witness. And at that point, then you're much more likely to be successful with the general proposition that these profoundly empowering statutes are implied. Other comments or questions?
I wanted to be sure to applaud Miss Cynthia. She has a wonderful voice, and it's not overmodulated, and I can make out what she's saying today. Thank you.
I think, Cynthia, this is Abraham, Nevada. There has always been a distinct difference between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and it's two different bodies of thought. And I think what Charles is referring to is that you can have this thing stitched together so tightly that in the opposition mind, they would be able to brew any kind of horror that we would be able to authoritatively get away with imposing upon them should they not capitulate to what is right. I think that's what Charles is saying, that once we're assembled, once we're intact, once we have the momentum, that those types of possibilities can become very doable. Because something is doable, if the opponent knows it's doable, that usually is enough of a deterrent, so it does not have to be done.
Yeah. Just like with the Samoan, you don't need to resort to violence when you've got the overwhelming presence and logic and reason for the justification of your actions.
And Charles, that guy who ran that auto parts store, he was aggressive, he was hostile, he was trying to come across like a Bronx jabroni, and he was trying to be intimidated. And then when we showed up, because you know, I told the guy that I was working with, I said, we're going to go get the Samoan I know, and we're going to come over here, we're going to shut this guy up. But I didn't know the Samoan had all these tricks up his sleeve, but it worked like a charm. And it wasn't so much that the guy was big, right? But it was more so that this guy knew that the Samoan had, this was not new to him. He was rehearsed, and he just knew that whatever tanglement that he would try to put up against the Samoan and what we were doing, he would lose drastically. So he started backpedaling dramatically. It was shameful. How he started, you saw somebody who went from a tiger to a mouse in almost a moment. I was embarrassed.
I'm really glad you're sharing that, Abraham. That's great. And I do believe you're recognizing that exact same scenario is very likely to occur if we engineer our judicial investigations that we were referring to.
Well, absolutely. You would have dry runs. You would have staged dry runs so that you could get the dynamics and the protocols down so that once you're doing it live, it would unfold according to script as best can be anticipated, but it should unfold, you know, very properly. The Samoan, he was rehearsed. He had done this before. But there was still a slight hesitancy with his mannerisms. But it was executed so effectively that the other fella backpedaled and started to kowtow immediately. And it was incredible to watch that happen.
That's a great testimony, Abraham. I'm really glad you shared it. Comments, questions, anybody?
I think that's the direction we're going in. That's what we're going to have to do, something like that.
Yeah, well, especially the bad guys are looming, plugs into the aircraft carriers off the coast and the whole coronavirus thing. They're locking down a military police state over us. And the local police departments and sheriff's departments are probably going to be mindless sock puppets for that whole evil empire, New World Order agenda, unless we throw down the gauntlet and tell them, just like we're talking about, that we're not going to have it anymore.
Yeah, there's going to have to be some practice for sure.
I totally agree with that. It's about strategy and everything, and know what you have going on and who you're working with. And the strategy is very, very important. Just like when you play chess, it's all about the strategy. And you play, and you say that God had, like, he was kind, even though he practiced it and you know he did it many times, what he was probably doing is his strategy, because every human being reacts on a situation somewhat differently. And so his strategy, like, he knows this really works, but he has to pay attention to his opponent, because his opponent probably can change the game at any time. So that man probably wouldn't have backed down. And what if he didn't? He had game B or game
C. I thought he was gonna sick the pit bulls on us. I didn't realize that the Samoan did work so well, because this guy had three big vicious pit bulls behind the counter, and I thought he was gonna sick them on us. but he was afraid for his pit bulls. He thought the pit bulls would all be in jail too.
But the whole thing is, with that ammonia guy, he was probably paying attention to his opponent, because, and he see that he was really taking control of it, so he went even further. But he probably had another plan. But it's always good, because you don't always just think that another man is going to react the same way that other guy acted that other day. But then you also have a game plan. If he didn't, what else would I do? Do I have another game plan? So he was a little, like, paying attention to this guy, every way this guy was moving, the way he was holding, carrying his body. That's very important when you're going into a situation that, with another person.
This guy was a bodyguard, you know, for a lot of rap stars. So he already knew the violent encounter.
Exactly.
And he already knew how to psychologically dominate.
So he had some wonderful skills. You know, his strategy was pretty good. But then you got to always remember, don't judge the book by its cover. And even though this guy was, like, he did it many times and it worked that way, but you said that he had, like, this attitude, like, he was kind of unsure. It wasn't about he was unsure. He was really checking out and he's very keen. He seemed to be
very right. He was assessing and analyzing spontaneously.
Exactly. So that was, I think he was very, very, very intelligent in that way, because he was checking out his opponent. And afterwards,
me and him had a little talk, right? Because he could have pushed it further. And I asked him, I said, why didn't you go further? He says, I didn't want to get in over my head, because if the guy had called the cops and I really had no jurisdiction and no lawful authority, he said, I didn't want to push it too far where they were going to have to call the police, because he was acting as though he was functioning in official capacity, but he was really just bluffing. But the bluff worked well.
Yeah. Yes, pretty good.
It was amazing. I wish I would have recorded it. I just thought it was brilliant. I talked to the Samoan for a good half hour after that, and tried to read his mind, understand his movement, because I had to do a lot of collections on these camera systems that people just would hesitate paying us. And so I had to go do a lot of these collections myself. So I had to employ some of these kinds of tactics, but I was not as effective as he was with the little pen camera and quoting and citing different sections of law. It was very intimidating and very effective. And this guy who fancied himself as a wolf turned into a mouse immediately.
That's a great story, Abraham.
I think that we can rehearse something like this, and we can deploy it just as well.
Yeah. Well, as we properly build our community,
we won't be bluffing.
Right. And what we need is people with individual cases on the ground that are willing to throw down the gauntlet in front local bureaucrats. That's essential element number one. And essential element number two is have at least, I dare suggest, at least two people willing to walk in with you to do that judicial investigation or similar confrontation.
Well, when it's executed properly, Charles, there's no confrontation. There's just capitulation, because that's what it was. It was capitulation.
Well, to the law. Everybody is subject to the law, and those people that were previously resistant to lawful authority, now all of a sudden law is being correctly articulated to them in their face, and they are recognizing finally the inferiority of their previously held position, and they're subjecting themselves to the laws which are common in the local community there.
I kind of envision, you know, those in the movie, Gladiator, where they have the big war scene in the beginning of the movie, where you have the Roman Empire's troops on one side, you have the barbarians' troops on the other side, and before the war engages, you have a formation. And the strategy and the deployment of that formation is, as the enemy approaches, then your formation quickly changes to adapt to the oncoming threat. And then you have your arrows come out, you have your catapults come out. So you have all different tactical strategies from your position, you know, being deployed strategically. I imagine a microcosm of that, where you might have 8 to 10 people go in on one of these kinds of events, and you have a strategy that's kind of like a microcosm of the way these Romans deployed their forces, with the many elements of those forces coming to bear depending on what was presented to them. So they had an infinite amount of variability to the response. I think something like that can be done if we studied the terrain very well.
And you know, yeah, that is exactly true, because that's exactly what the judges do. Because when I was in the courtroom and I was talking with confidence, and he mentioned things because I didn't know a lot about certain things, I said the wrong thing. And when I did that, he got confident again, because he's looking for that fear. And he asks you different things just to see how much you do know.
Yeah, it's the changing nature of the battlefield.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they do to you. When they find out that you have any type of fear, or you don't know exactly what you're talking about, it's smoke and mirrors. And that's what they go. That's what they do. But if they feel, and if you can make them think that you know exactly what you're doing, and you're not going to stand down, and
you're
talking
about by yourself. The thing is not to be caught out there by yourself, because
exactly.
He's got the district attorney. He's got all those idiots behind him playing the game. If you've got your team assembled properly and you have your strategy intact and you can move on a moment's notice as the battlefield changes, then you can keep him in deep check and keep him on the defensive rather than you get pushed into the defensive.
But and that's what I was telling Charles. Yeah, that's what I was telling Charles. I said, we got to go in there together as well, you know. You have to have somebody, like, I'm here by myself here, okay? And everybody around me, like, oh, you're going to go to jail. Oh, you're talking against the judge like this or something like that. We have to get together as a team.
You have to have a psychological force, not so much a physical force, but mostly a psychological force.
Exactly.
Now, many hands make light work, and so you need many hands together, many minds, you know, being able to have one unified projection.
That's what we don't have. I mean, we're building it, and people are coming more aware of it. And so I see it's moving. It's moving because a lot of people, that's why I said it has to be knowledge, because a lot of our people that's asleep really feel like this is the law, and when they say something, you must do it.
You know, Cynthia, the thing is this, these bullies, and that's what they are, bullies, because not many people can develop the fortitude to really contest them. And if they do, it's a half-hearted contest. So these bullies, once they come up against anybody who's got any kind of formidable type of opposition, they will fold like a cheap suit. They will duck cover and they will run because they're not accustomed to a force equal or superior to theirs coming out with ferocity and knowledge and stability and being able to project that right in their face. They will become so fearful, I will feel sad for them. Just like I felt for that shop owner, how quickly he became a cow, how quickly he became a little duck.
Exactly. That's almost like what the movie Yellow Brick Road. And when they went
Exactly. That's right. You know, the all-powerful wizard was really a little old man in the back. And once you realize what he's about, you know, then you just blow smoke up his butt. And that's it. He's done. He's finished with.
That's correct.
You know, one day maybe you might pick up the allegory of the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's an allegory. It was written as a political protest to what was happening in the country at that time. It's called the Wizard of Oz allegory. Have you ever looked into it?
No, I just understand the meaning behind it from a metaphysical point of view.
Yeah, well, one day you might want to pick I think a 12 or 13 page allegory that explains what's happening in the movie and why was the movie written. The guy who wrote the book ran for president 4 times and did not get elected, and the book was a protest, and he couldn't come out and directly protest, so he put it in the form of a children's story so that the meanings would be hidden.
Yes, what I got from metaphysics part of that is that we don't know, because they have put us to sleep in so many ways that we don't know how powerful, like they were looking for a heart and looking for this when we already have all this. But
she said the power was with her all the time. Well, she had to
exactly. The power is with us, but now they have us believe that it's not, because we just this poor little wrench when we're so
scarecrow. We're the scarecrow, the cowardly lion. You know, the rusty tin man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was beautiful for us to really look within and really realize that we are the power. We are the people with the power. They're just using our creation. They're using us.
Well, without the people and the labor, the courts have nothing.
And that's what they're using, because the fiat money, that's no money. I'm going to pay you. What they do is they take our creativity, our value. When you sign, even when you get a loan or anything, they're taking that money from you signing that, because that's your value for you to create the payment, and they just go out and invest it and do what they want to do with it. But without your signature.
Everyone on this call understands that dynamic very well.
Exactly, yeah. So we are the ones with the power, and we're letting them use our value. They're taking out, because they can't, these mimics and these creatures cannot do anything. They can't create anything. We're the ones creating everything. We are the seed. It's a spiritual warfare. We are the seed that's creating everything, and they're using our creation because they just mimic everything.
Yeah, they're dependent on us.
That's what you call parasites. They're parasitic.
Yeah, the archons.
Yeah. Yeah, they are parasites. That's a real good analogy, Cynthia. And that relates to the concept of the body politic, where there's communities of people that are responsible for the government, and they are the self-governing. The self-governing communities are diametrically opposed to the parasite individuals and communities, and they're organized. that the parasite communities are organized to pillage and plunder. They are definitely more organized than us. The very Roman Empire nature of the federal and state level of government is civil municipal, which is based upon economic municipal bonds, which is essentially slavery, which is when you enslave other people, and that's parasitical. That's what they're doing. And a lot of the task at hand, we're in a battle for the minds and hearts of the people, because once we get enough minds and hearts of people harmonizing with us and going, yeah, this sounds good, this community is worthy of investing my time and energy in, it's worthy for me to call in regular and participate in their conferences, once we get enough numbers like that, then we will start making progress. And so it's a battle for the minds and hearts of the people, and their under ability to use words such as parasite and body politic to explain things in a more fundamental and clear and organic nature, that makes light bulbs go off in people's heads. They go, hey, these people aren't just a bunch of kooks. They're actually making sense on something that I can comprehend. I can comprehend things now that are bigger and more important than other things that I've ever comprehended before. This is a really valuable group. I want to continue participating in this group because there's probably other things that I don't know that they're going to be informing me of too. See, at that point, we get loyalty. We get trust. People come to trust us because we are talking about real issues instead of all the cowards and sock puppets of the evil empire that are surrounding us.
So, do you want to take this a step further?
Nikki, if possible, if you've got something that can actually improve, even if you don't, go ahead.
Let me go ahead. Okay, in the Declaration of Independence, one of the faults that they found with that government at the time was that they sent swarms of officers to eat out their substance. This goes along with parasites, right? And if you go back in scripture to Genesis 9:27, it says God shall enlarge Japheth. Japheth is the grandfather of Ashkenaz. He will dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. Canaan, of course, is the merchant class, right? Or was the merchant group. So Shem, the people who call themselves Jews and are not, are the ones that are eating out the substance, right? So they used to say WASP. Was that really white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, or was it white Anglo-Saxon parasites based on, the genetic makeup of who it is that is in charge, even of Israel at this present time, with the handshake and the wink in 1917 between Balfour and Rothschild, and the creating of the state of Israel. I just had to throw that in when you started talking about parasites. I yield.
Nikki, actually, it's the Rothschild. I know exactly what you're talking about. And when you said parasites, you should add Anglo-Saxon. Well, actually, what they talk about, the suit that I am in, we have more melanin because we are basically, when it comes to the suit, it is the oldest, the template. And so that's why you have melanin. Just like an oak tree has more chlorophyll than any other plant. Because when I started doing in the metaphysics and I started relating to trees, they told me if I wanted to get the highest, whatever, would go to an oak tree because it has more chlorophyll, which now say that we're not the body, and we are transferred into different bodies as we reincarnate. But the original template, the first original template, in my understanding, this the window that I look out of, is what we call the black suit. That's more melanin. But so therefore, a lot of the entities of the fourth dimension presided, because it was easier, into what we call the Anglo-Saxon white suit. But it has nothing to do, because you're not this body. So I don't want to even make you anybody think that I'm saying on a race level, because there's no such thing as race. We're a species of different suits with different energy, feminine and masculine, and it depends on the light, no matter what suit you have on. But yes, these entities took over the Anglo-Saxon, that the Rothschilds and all that on the fourth dimension did take over what we call on the third dimension the white suit. So you're absolutely correct.
Well, it's I'm just reading from scripture. The historical evidence is there, and I know that generally children are not darker than their darkest parent. So I know where you're coming from. So don't worry about it.
Yes.
I yield.
Thank you both. Yes, this is a good, healthy discussion. Sometimes the best discussion happens in the open, free flow and exchange of ideas. And yeah, again, these kinds of discussions about who are the parasites and who's the organic body politic that's being victimized are healthy discussions that like among us here, this is rather a rehearsal. But when we talk with new people and we've rehearsed these kind of discussions, we know how to make a good argument because we've, you know, done a little bit of intellectual swordplay with our friends here in the forum, then we can make these points to the new people. We can make the light bulbs go off in their head to where all of a sudden they are comprehending things at a more deeper and profound level. And at that point, again, a little bit of redundancy here, we build trust. There's volumes of law books written on trust. Trust is a fundamental constitutional issue. It's higher than contracts. If you've got contracts are just basically commercial entanglements. When you've got a trust agreement, you've got a deeper level of commitment than a mere contract. There are trust is all public servants, including those under the municipal Roman Empire civil model of government, are in positions of trust. That's why they take oaths to support the Constitution. That is their position of trust, with the descriptions of the public office that they have taken an oath to fill the duties of within the parameters of the Constitution. So we're building the trust communities. And it's very good wording, like when conducting the judicial investigations or otherwise communicating with public servants, to open the discussion by saying things like, you realize as a public servant, you're in a position of public trust here. That's a legal phrase available in Black's Law Dictionary. Public trust. That's different than just private trust. Private trusts are similar to contracts. Public trust is a duty that public servant owes to everybody in the public. And it's of a higher authority and obligation. It increases the duties and burdens on the public servant to be in a position of public trust like that. And they're under. We're empowering common people to develop concepts in their minds about how to hold people accountable that are causing them the problems and that are in position of public trust but are presently violating that public trust. And it's so routine and common that our good people that are coming to our conferences are probably pessimistic that we're going to be able to come up with any answers that might provide any hope for them. But when they hear us talk about parasites and accountability
and the right of citizens' arrest and the right of judicial investigations and small communities of people to go into public offices with cameras running and a couple witnesses. When we start talking about that, then light bulbs go off in their head and our community trust just has one new member that recognizes the merits of what we're talking about and wants to link with us, because this empowerment is at our fingertips, and it's self-evident that our community power will increase significantly once we reach a critical mass, a threshold number of people participating in these conferences and what we're doing here. So, any comments, questions? I yield. It's kind of slowing down here a little bit, everybody. I'm kind of thinking about bringing the conference to a conclusion. I'm kind of out of song and dance and entertainment here. Well, not really. If anybody wants to petition me to do more song and dance and entertainment, I'll probably do that. But outside of a formal request like that, I'm kind of inclined to just abandon the spotlight and wind the conference down here. Comments, questions, requests, anybody? Looks like we lost Abraham. Matt from Michigan, I want to let you know this is the first time in a while you've attended our conferences. Really glad to see you. Hope you come back. And David and Pam in Michigan also from the Thumb. Glad to see you guys here. Cynthia and Nikki, always glad to have both of you participating. Anybody? Comments, questions?
Well, I didn't comment on when you were talking about bitcoins and stuff like that. Actually, when you were talking about it, which that's going to be how we're going to handle money, but I don't believe it's going to be bitcoin because it's centralized. And we just found out, and we have a good feeling that it was backed by Rothschild and the Chinese, basically. And it's like they had back doors, which is really, I think Bitcoin's at 19,000 now. But actually, it's backed by fiat, basically. But one coin that we're looking into, which I have invested in, was Metal One, and is decentralized, because that's what we are going for now, is decentralized, and that's the new wave of the future. But Bitcoin was a smoke and mirror as well. But it's doing very well now. So if you had money invested and then you take it out and change it into something else. But these coins that's on the market now, on that's centralized, they're not going to be the future situation. But Bitcoin's brought out the situation where that's where we're going. But we're not going to allow these parasites to take control of it anymore. So we're looking for coins that's centralized. So if you want to invest in it, you're going to look forward to something that's decentralized, besides centralized, because that's the monetary system, the Roman system still. And Bitcoin is owned by Rothschild and the Chinese, I believe, yes. They were saying things about that. So be careful with that and thinking you want to keep that coin and it's going to be worthless.
Mm-hmm. I have similar reservations about Bitcoin. I'm not sure it's owned by Rothschild, but you could be right on that. I just don't know. But I do think what we're talking about, of instead of just Bitcoin's creating credits out of thin air, what we're talking about in the alternative currency system I discussed, the people at the grassroots level are the source of the credit rather than just fiction. So I think what we're talking about is a superior alternative economic system than Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about when I said decentralized is going to be the value of the people. And when it's decentralized and out of this monetary system, so that's exactly what you're saying. But you had mentioned Bitcoin, and I because when nobody knew who was the owner of Bitcoin, it was always a secret. And because I invested in some of those things, and we find out that they had like back doors, and they were taking, when you thought that that you had money in there, it was no money in there because they had back doors and they were stealing your money out of there, and they were holding a lot, which it happened to me. They said, oh, this security, and they hold my money for 2 months as the money was going up and down, and I couldn't get it out. I had to go through all types of stuff. And I heard a lot of people didn't even get their money out because they had back doors, and they were saying on the website you had this amount of money in there when it wasn't. So that's an investigation going on with that situation with the back doors that they had, but it was totally illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for those details, Cynthia. That's I do know there was some backdoor type of problems in Bitcoin. I think the CIA had a hand in engineering Bitcoin and creating those backdoors and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but I'm kind of thinking about winding the conference to a close here. Is there any objections from anybody? Hearing none. Again, I want to emphasize I'm really happy for the participation of all of you here. If there's no objections, I'm going to stop the recording and end the conference here. Last call. Any objections? Anybody got anything else to say in conclusion here before we shut down? Hearing none. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.